Our second speaker is Dr. Ann Cashin, Associate Professor, Chair of Acute and Chronic Care Department at the College of Nursing at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. She is one of our first graduates of the SGI program, so we're very proud of her and her work. Her experience and insight in how genetic methodologies can be incorporated into biobehavioral and outcome research, I'm sure, is going to be very stimulating and insightful.
Mary, thank you very much, and I would like to thank NINR for asking me to speak today on genomic applications, transitioning genomic knowledge from the domain of basic scientists into the domain of nursing through nursing education, research, and practice is certainly a passion that I have. Much of the story begins with the Human Genome Project, which resulted in an explosion of molecular genetics and genomic methodologies. We are seeing the downstream effect of that on our ability to identify those at risk, to diagnose disease, and to stratify disease and determine treatment and prognosis. This is particularly true in the area of cancer therapies. Genomics is relevant to nursing research in that the NIH roadmap stresses the importance of interdisciplinary teams and translational research. For example, my own program of research relies heavily on an interdisciplinary team composed of those with molecular science background and bioinformatics. I will be discussing this a little bit more further in the presentation. In addition, genetic methods are the newest tool for practice and research. Things like viral loads are being obtained using newer genetic methodologies. We're also seeing that there's a public demand for using these newer genetic methodologies and that there's a need for patient education. Yesterday, when I was preparing my presentation on the plane coming here, the person sitting next to me was reading over my shoulder, unknown to me at the time. She then began telling me that she had just had genetic testing done for colon cancer and that the first test had come back negative, but then the second test, which was on the biopsy, had come back positive. And so she was asking me whether or not she could trust the results of the genetic test. So I'm sitting there on the plane, you know, thinking about what I was going to be telling y'all and the importance of this information to us. And I sat there and I really discussed genetic testing. And I realized how much we really need to teach our students so that they cannot necessarily say with definitive answer that genetic testing is accurate and valid for all types of cancer. But at least they can give some parameters and they have some knowledge so they don't just say, I have no clue. The second experience, again, was yesterday. I had dinner with a friend, and she was asking about genetic testing because her family is having it done. They're looking at a new mutation at Harvard that's looking at a gene that controls puberty onset, and she's been asked to be in a study. So now she wants me to talk to her about genetic testing in terms of the ethical issues and potential discrimination. Those are topics that are now being discussed in baccalaureate programs as well as other nursing programs, and I'm highly supportive of them, having had two random examples of the need for that occur to me just yesterday. So not only is there a need for it, and the public's asking us these questions, but we also see that this, along with Dr. Zerhouni, thank you. Dr. Zerhouni today was talking about is that we need a paradigm shift. And what they're saying is that genomic health care is going to be based on health promotion and disease prevention. And as we look at genomic healthcare, it's going to transition from the medical model of treatment-oriented paradigm to more prevention-oriented paradigm. And that's where nursing centers most of its care. What does it take? It takes an interdisciplinary team. Nurses can't do all of the, are not going to be trained in all of the areas that are needed for this interdisciplinary work. So now we have professional teams that are composed of those with PhDs in such areas of chemistry, molecular science, bioinformatics, and nursing. Because I have so little time today, I'm really not going to spend a lot of time explaining the methods, the precise methods, and another reason is because they'll probably change tomorrow as this techniques continually refine and expand. But I will instead present how my findings have influenced patient care. The take-home message is that basic scientists and nurses can run these tests, and that we're teaching students at all levels to conduct them. The first study, well, actually, I'm going to be presenting results from two studies from my NINR-funded program of research. The first study uses real-time PCR, and the second study is using microarray applications. The first study evaluated the different expression of biomarkers, and the three biomarkers we were examining were granzyme B, perforin, and human leukocyte antigen, HLA-DR. We looked at peripheral blood, and we were looking at transplant recipients, those who had received a pancreas transplant. And we had patients in our group that had had experienced a rejection episode. And so some of them had rejection and some did not. The reason we're interested in this is because it's a major clinical issue to those in nursing. Acute rejection is a major problem for pancreas transplant, and we have about 10% immunologic graft loss. There are no universally accepted clinical indicators of pancreas allograft rejection. Now, nurse practitioners manage the care of these patients, and so it is an important nursing issue. And biomarkers of rejection have been identified for kidney and islet transplant recipients. In biologic research, there is always a conceptual model. Whether or not they show it to you, I want everyone to realize that it is there. Our model looks at the cytotoxic lymphocyte, which attaches to the renal allograft cell. Once the lymphocyte attaches to the cell, markers, and you'll see that these are the names I was just talking about, the vas ligand, the granzyme B, and the perforin are released. And what I'm doing in my program of research is measuring using real-time PCR levels of these three biomarkers. So the hypothesis is that the elevation of these three biomarkers would precede allograft destruction. So we had a cross-sectional design descriptive study where pancreas transplant recipients experienced organ rejection. Now, the first thing that we did was design primers and probes. These are important in actually measuring those biomarkers. So the importance of this particular slide is to show that I did this in conjunction with some of my interdisciplinary teammates, and we do this over the internet. You do some preliminary work, you design the primers and probes, and then you place an order over the internet, just like you do with Amazon.com, and these little things come in a package, and you can begin your research program at that point. It's fairly standardized at this point, and it's not really a big deal. The patient characteristics, I'm primarily going to say that the two groups are very similar. Again, we had two groups with seven in each. One were experiencing clinical signs and symptoms of rejection, and the other was not. It was a cross-sectional study. Our results, let me orient you to this slide. Again, we have our three biomarkers, granzyme, perforin, and HLA-DR. I am not talking today about the control groups, so just ignore these two groups. I am speaking about my rejection group and my non-rejection group. What I'm hoping you can see on this slide is that the rejection group has higher levels of each marker than the non-rejection group has. That's the general gist of this slide. The significance is not there between the two groups. However, I was not surprised that there was no significance because my original hypothesis said that these markers would be elevated prior to clinical signs and symptoms of rejection. We want to find it early so that we can actually treat it before the organ is destroyed. So we went to another, we actually are continuing the study, and we're looking at longitudinal markers. And this is funded through NINR. So you can see at this point, I have multiple time points. The y-axis is looking at the level of the three biomarkers. The x-axis is looking at time. So over a 3-month or 25-week period, we're looking at the three different markers. And the arrow on the slide shows you where the biopsy was done. The biopsy was our gold standard for whether or not there was rejection. You can see that the markers are elevated approximately 3 weeks, or at least two of the markers were elevated approximately 3 weeks prior to the clinical rejection episode was diagnosed. At the 3 weeks prior to, there were no signs and symptoms of the rejection, but yet the markers that we're looking at were elevated. So that's an important finding. This is a case study, so it's only one. So we've got others that we're continually, we actually have the blood. Now we're trying to do all the analysis. You can see that on HLA-DR, the marker actually elevated following biopsy. So what's going on there is yet to be determined, and some follow-up work will be done with that. So these are some preliminary results of what we are finding. But it does hold true with the hypothesis that we were doing. So this basically says the same thing, that serial measurements could be used. They could be drawn while the patient comes to the clinic, and we, once the analysis is done, we could determine based on that type of blood work on whether or not the patient's organ was damaged, and hopefully treat it prior to damage. So our second study looked at microarrays, and now one of the problems following transplant is that many people gain a lot of weight. On this particular slide, we're with kidney transplant population. We see that that at baseline it's 31% who are normal and 34% are obese. At 1 year after transplant, almost 50% are obese and only 21% are normal. So this is a problem that we have and that we are addressing. So I wanted to look and see if we could get some data on this. And we did microarrays on 12 individuals, and we divided them into two groups. When you're looking, this particular result shows you the hierarchical clustering. And you have those who are low BMI compared to those who are high BMI. And you're looking at patterns of color. And you see that they are actually grouped. And there's more of the red intensity here, the blue intensity there, and again, there's more red intensity here. And that's what you want to see. Each line is actually one particular person. So we're looking for patterns. Again, the bioinformatics individual comes in, and they would help me interpret this. And then we would look at functions, because this showed us that we had over 800 genes that correlated with BMI, and that we could get this high-quality RNA from our immunocompromised patients. And we could manage these large databases, and that findings actually could be used to identify those who would at risk, and that we could intervene. So these studies illustrate that nurses can lead interdisciplinary teams that apply genetic methods to study patient outcomes. And the part here I wanted to say is that we could actually lead them. I think that our skill set is such that we can provide input and knowledge from communication, socialization to pathophysiology, and so we can bring a good skill set to the table. Genetic research can apply directly to patient care, as we're seeing in our transplant clinic, and that interdisciplinary teams make this actually possible. So I'd like to thank my colleagues from nursing, basic science, from medicine, and also our doctoral students. Thank you very much.